Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 400 CTOs who share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insights into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. Thanks a lot to our sponsor, The About You Cloud. The About You Cloud offers a full-stack e-commerce solution as a service that runs on exactly the same infrastructure as the About You Shop does. It is mobile-first, can act as headless system, event-driven, can be fully localized, and is super integrated into existing solutions. Besides that, it is designed and developed by a really smart CTO and friend of mine, Sebastian Betz. About You has set up a task force for retailers and brands that want to be quick in the COVID situation. This task force will help you with the launch of your shop, as well as with fulfillment, marketing, support, and internationalization. Simply write to hello@aboutyou.com to be supported by this task force. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. Today, my guest is Peter Großkopf. He was actually a guest a while ago when he was still CTO of Börse Stuttgart and built a trading platform there. And I kind of like the idea of looking a bit deeper into the universe of crypto. I mean, it's kind of a very hyped topic. And Peter just quit his job to actually build his masterpiece, a decentralized finance bank. Maybe Peter, you want to tell us a bit more about that and your crazy brain fuck topics.
Hey Toby, yeah, thanks for having me the second time. It's a pleasure to talk here. It's such a pity that we can't meet in the physical world these days because I'm really missing the AlphaList events that you organized with your colleagues a few times already. I transitioned, so I'm now a free man again for a few weeks and started working on my new baby. And so maybe to describe a bit the way how I transitioned also into what I do today. I worked I helped to start Solaris Bank a few years back, which is a bank that acts as an API endpoint for fintech companies, offering kind of technology to them so that they can offer banking business, but also a license. That has been an incredible ride because it has been my first touch point with banking at all. And so I learned a lot how banking and how the finance world works. And during these days when I was working there, the blockchain hype came up for the first time. So it was like in end of 2016, beginning of 2017. Some of you remember these crazy rallies at the cryptocurrency exchanges. So that triggered my attention, and I started to think about like, well, so there's this blockchain thing coming up and everybody is talking about replacing banks and building a completely new financial service infrastructure. So I thought, well, we're a bank, so we don't want to get redundant. What do we need to do, and what impact would it have if blockchain takes over? So I started to wrap my head around decentralized banking and the impact on the banks. Unfortunately, I was not able to fulfill my vision like in a complete way. As crypto winter came, the blockchain topic lost a bit of interest in the public world. But I was able to join Börse Stuttgart as a CTO and managing director, and we built up a centralized exchange, so like a trading venue for cryptocurrencies. I did this for 2 years. And in the meanwhile, I figured out that the topic of decentralized finance and blockchain picked up again, and probably in a much stronger way as it did in the past. And so I would even say that I'm now pretty convinced that it's not like experimental anymore. I'm really convinced that it will, now really hit the mainstream and become something big. And therefore, it's now the right time also to start to work on it and contribute also to the community to make decentralized finance really mainstream.
So it's here to stay. So maybe we start a bit earlier. So maybe you can explain a bit better for CTOs and techies, what is a blockchain and where does it come from?
Yeah. It's a good question actually, I would start with a very simple definition. And to me, when I explain blockchain, it's a distributed database with unknown participants. So maybe to lay it a little bit deeper, so distributed databases are a common thing, and probably most CTOs have interacted with them. And in the end, typical for a distributed database is that that you're running it completely under your governance. So you probably have like a AWS or like a data center, and you operate databases in there. And to these databases, it's completely known who is interacting with it and where the data is stored and so on. So it's like all the users are known. And in blockchains, it's actually not, because blockchains are distributed over the web. So for example, Bitcoin or Ethereum nodes can be run and maintained almost everywhere. So it's like in different countries, different data centers, somebody could operate a node in the kitchen on a server. And in the end, everybody is interacting with the system. And therefore, you need to install consensus mechanisms and certain ways of interaction so that you can really be sure that the data that is stored and added and kind of changed in this distributed database, that it's always valid and not manipulated. And that's actually the big difficulty also for blockchains, and where I would also say where the big innovation is coming from. Because also, if you look back into computer science in the past, so there's I think we all learned in university back in the days kind of from the big computer scientists who figured out certain problems in computer science that had to be solved. And one of them has been this two generals problem. So kind of the Byzantine generals problem, where two generals are attacking one city, and the city is in the middle of them too. And now they want to find an agreement on when to attack the city. And actually, the problem is that if only one of the two armies attacks the city, so they will lose. They can only win when both armies actually attack at the same time. And but the problem is, if the messenger needs to pass through the city to let the other general know when to attack the city, you can't rely on that information. And in the end, blockchains are dealing with this Byzantine generals problem by defining consensus mechanisms, so that you actually are able to find a consensus on certain aspects and certain truths and can act upon it.
Okay, and why is it actually called crypto at the end?
Yeah, it's called crypto because blockchains in the end is a combination of different techniques. So on the one hand, you have this decentralized database, it's also called, like in the more blockchain specific speech, we're talking about a distributed ledger. So it's like a series of data that is held, and which is actually organized in blocks. We're talking about a little bit later. So therefore, it's called the blockchain, and additionally, blockchains make use a lot of 70s cryptography, so namely asymmetric cryptography, like having public keys, private keys, electronic signatures, hashes, and combines it into like an overall concept where you can really rely on the information which is processed in the blockchain.
So that means that each block is generated and somehow cryptographically safe, so that you can actually validate it quite easily. Like, let's say a JW token, where everyone can validate that it has been generated by a trusted source, right?
Yeah, exactly. So maybe I explain a little bit like the general concept of the blockchain, how this works. So in the end, it's about making transactions, right? So if you take, for example, the Bitcoin blockchain, it's about making financial transactions. And the whole idea is that if somebody wants, or somebody triggers an interaction, if somebody triggers a transaction, then I didn't have enough coffee today. First these transactions are sent kind of to the overall network, and then there's different roles in that network. So there's for example the miners, the miners collect all these transactions, so the first thing they do is they do like a verification if it's like a real transaction. For example, in Bitcoin, it checks that there's really like an unspent transaction output that can be used in the transaction. So if you want to send one Bitcoin to somebody, that you don't have like zero on your UTXO, so because you can't spend something that you don't have. So that needs to be verified, but also it needs to be verified that this transaction from the wallet address is really valid. And this means the transaction gets signed with the private key of this wallet, and therefore it's like an electronic signature where miners can verify that the owner of that private key made the transaction. So that's kind of like the first usage for cryptography asymmetric cryptography. Then the next thing that is done is when all these transactions are collected and verified, then these all are kind of like wrapped together to start proposing a block. And this block proposal in Bitcoin works in a way that the miners have to solve a specific cryptographic puzzle that they solve. And get very simplistic, it works in a way that they have to propose a block that has like a specific amount of zeros kind of in front of the address, and that's kind of like an, and in the end they take the transactions, they create an hash, they look on the result of the hash, and if this result of the hash doesn't match to these amount of numbers that's in the hash address, then they try again by adding there's a field where they can put different characters in there, so different input, and then they recalculate the hash again, and this is performed as oftentimes up to the point that this hash address matches the difficulty of this puzzle, and then this block is proposed to the whole network and gets verified again and so on, and written to the blockchain. And the term blockchain in the end comes from the fact that each block refers to the previous block, or to the previous block's hash address, which means it gives you the full history of the whole network, so that you can navigate from kind of like hash address to hash address to hash address to the previous blocks. And so to make sure that the blockchain is not changed in the future, so that there's like manipulation of unspent transaction outputs and so on. In the end, hashes come in again, because once you change like a number in previous transactions, the whole hash would look completely different, and in the end, the blockchain wouldn't be consistent anymore. And so, kind of like very simply speaking, all these usages of different technologies, so using hashes, using asymmetric cryptography, and using this concept of the blockchain wrapped up all together, like with a consensus mechanism, makes the specific blockchain.
Okay. And you can already hear why it's slow, right? So writing is slow, I guess. That is a challenge in the blockchain, which is in a way logic, right? I mean, if you just compare it to, let's say, a master replication in databases, then you also have the problem that if you write to one, everyone else has to know, or you apply concepts semi-complete records where you can't rely on them being consistent, right?
Yeah, exactly. And also the speed can, or the speed also correlates with the type of blockchain, if you want. So, for example, when talking about a distributed database, like in the introduction, it's kind of there, the participants are known, and therefore you don't need to spend so much energy also into such a consensus mechanism and to really validate every participant. And so there's, for example, blockchains, they're called permission blockchains, and it's in the end private blockchains, consortium based blockchains. So there's different terminology for it. So like Corda, like Hyperledger, there's also an enterprise Ethereum, and you can run these blockchains on your own infrastructure or also in a network where all the participants are known. And so there's also a term for a consensus mechanism called proof of authority, which in the end says that once the participants are known to the network and you need to kind of apply for being part of the network and so on and so forth, you can actually give much more trust to these participants, and therefore you can lower the amount of work that you need to put into the consensus algorithm, and that usually also makes the blockchains faster. But okay, still, and it's so that it's probably my personal opinion, but also covered in the wild world by others. So I always said that to me personally, permissionless blockchains, so public blockchains like the Bitcoin one, Ethereum, Tezos, and so on, that's to me the real blockchain, because due to the fact that it's public and that everybody can interact with it and so on, this really makes the innovation, and this also really creates this paradigm shift that we also will talk about today.
Yeah, true. So otherwise you just have like a master database which is distributed amongst your bank, for example. If I'm Deutsche Bank, I would potentially go for something like that, right? I wouldn't go for the public chain, but I would try to build my own internal blockchain, which would then, yeah, just be like a collection of nodes that I host somewhere, right?
Yeah, and it's also these discussions that that I sometimes have amongst the CTO group or with other CTO peers, because in the end, we are all technology driven, and we really love the technology that kind of makes our digital world. And but in the end, for the user usually doesn't care. And therefore, you can build an application that's running like on a centralized system or like a service oriented architecture or whatever, it will produce the same results. Mostly, yeah. But you can also build it on blockchain and Web3. So I see positive aspects coming from this having public information, public infrastructure, public data, and giving everybody the ability to interact with it. But still, it's just, if it's about building something in an MVP way and solving a problem for a user, doing it with a blockchain and build up your own node infrastructure probably wouldn't, for many problems, not be the starting point to solve it.
Okay. You just mentioned one buzzword, which is Web3, which I think comes from the Ethereum world, right? So I think it's really like a good starting point to actually look at Ether and Solidity, the programming language, which is quite close to JavaScript, and actually see what are the use cases there. And as far as when I looked into it, it was mostly gambling. So there were like a lot of gambling projects. I think which now went over into like the new buzzword NFT, where you can trigger a transaction from your browser with a browser plugin, and you have an API called Web3, which you can use to trigger a transaction. And with this, you could, for example, interact with crypto countries where you could buy like a virtual country in the Ether world, which would be like permanently yours, and people really pay money for that. I don't know how this developed. Maybe you can give us a better feeling. I mean, will you build your DeFi bank on behalf of Ether, or what are you going to do?
Yeah, so maybe I start a little bit earlier. Well, so there's like I said, a bunch of different blockchains these days. From my point of view, there's like a very fast development from, let's say, first generation blockchains to second generation blockchains and third, fourth, fifth. So it's developing very quickly. And to me, Bitcoin is still like a very stunning example for technology, because it was possible to build up like an alternative financial system to trigger transactions worldwide within like 11 years, and there's like a heavy usage on it. It's stable, so you haven't heard about hacks these days anymore. So it's really, and in the end, it solved this problem of consensus amongst unknown parties, which I'm super impressed, and where I really can say like it's amazing that this technology is out there and that it was invented. The second project that came into play is Ethereum, and Ethereum slightly covers a different aspect for the blockchain. So in the end, when Bitcoin is kind of a new financial infrastructure to wire money from A to B, then Ethereum is more this decentralized supercomputer where you can build decentralized applications, and this is something fundamentally different. Well, there are definitely Bitcoin maximalists saying, yeah, we also have the script language. So this language is called script, and you can build very simple tools on it. And in the end, Ethereum also was kind of a reaction of seeing people using script for building smart contracts and applications on top of Bitcoin, and figured out that there's a demand to come up with a new blockchain concept that enables application developers to build real decentralized applications. In the meanwhile, this whole topic also got developed further. So there's like a lot of different blockchains. There's Solana, very popular these days, also to build blockchain applications. There's forks of Ethereum where you can build applications on top. But still, I would say also for the development of Web3, Ethereum is the most important project also to have a look on. And now to respond to your question. So what is actually the Web3? So we all know the Web2, because Web2 was this development like 10 years ago, where a little bit more JavaScript driven applications were developed. Some of you still know the word Ajax. Haven't used it for a while now, because it became so common.
Wasn't Tim O'Reilly the one who actually invented Web2? Wasn't he the one who said, yeah, this is the Web 2.0?
Yeah, so I think there was something like that. And he organized these huge conferences and so on. But yeah, so the Web2 was kind of the social web. So people interacting in social networks, and like on the technical side, there was actually, it was also a whole old horse, because it was possible before, but it became this shiny name Ajax, so that you were able to interact more interactively with web applications, having tiny updates in your user interface, and become a little bit more, get this like fat client behavior for applications. And in the end, the term Web3 was formed by the also so-called Web3 Foundation, which is a group of people that propagate a new way of building applications for the future. And in the end, as also the blockchain development, so we probably all have heard of the story where Bitcoin was invented kind of as a like really very libertarian project really to have like a new banking system and developed by CryptoPunks, so people who really want to stay anonymous and who also are a little bit afraid of interactions of governmental offices. And in the end, the Web3 can become the internet that we all wanted to have like forever, because we know the web, the internet was developed as a technology that was supposed to run even after a nuclear war. So it was developed by the American army, so kind of as a communication system which is really able to maintain communication even if some of the nodes are down. And the web that we find today is kind of semi-centralized, because so there, for example, in Germany we had this net neutralism discussion going on for quite a while, so where the telecom providers can take decisions how much traffic to route to which company, and only if they pay more then Netflix gets more traffic and so on and so forth, which is in the end the complete opposite of having a free web where everybody is able to interact and can do whatever he or she wants. And with Web3, we now can navigate much more in that direction again, because the whole application stack that you're using to build applications is based on decentralized technology. So it starts with, for example, the Ethereum blockchain. So what makes it so special? The Ethereum blockchain, you have the concept of so-called smart contracts. So what are smart contracts? Smart contracts are tiny programs that are developed on the Ethereum blockchain, and they're written in Solidity, which is the proposed language for the Ethereum blockchain. And in the end, you write applications that you deploy to the Ethereum blockchain. So which means that it's kind of a public infrastructure that runs your application. It's not like AWS, where you are the only one having access to the data center and where you can do some private operations and so on and so forth. It's source code, which is public, so it's really visible on the blockchain, and it's accessible by everybody. And in the end, in the Web3 world, you build your application layer, so kind of like where all the logic is, on a public infrastructure that everybody can see, which is like a big paradigm shift. But what's the advantage of it? So in the end, once you write a smart contract and you deploy it to the Ethereum blockchain, it will run forever. Yeah, and especially when coming back to this aspect of net neutralism, and that there might be governmental interactions or actions to stop a service or something on the Ethereum blockchain, you're able to write code that runs forever, which is especially for these libertarian mindset people, it's like a really great way to go, because you can develop a neutral web. And in the end, the blockchain is used then for transactions. And so if you build an application, like a simple application on the Ethereum blockchain, it works in a way that first you need to have, of course, like a website with JavaScript for the starting point. And you would kind of sign up for your domain. You would do it on Unstoppable Domains, which is like a completely uncontrolled DNS provider. So also where you can get a domain and it will never stop running. Also kind of different to Denik and all these providers.
And who pays for it?
So you're paying for it. So it's in the end, it's using the Ethereum naming service. And you pay with Ether for it.
Oh, really? And if you stop paying, then it's also stops operating, or?
Yeah. So you sign up like for also a certain amount of time and so on. So it's in the end it's working the same way as normal registrars, but it's completely built in the Ethereum ecosystem. Yeah. So you have this domain service. And you build your website with JavaScript and so on, and you deploy it to something called IPFS. It's I would compare it with S3. So it's like a data center. It's completely decentralized, and you can use it for hosting data.
It's also interplanetary file system, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Ah, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, and so it's in the end it's like a decentralized S3, once the user opens your site, then he or she needs to connect with a wallet, and you also said it a little bit earlier. The most prominent wallet is MetaMask these days, so it's integrated in the Chrome browser, and in the end you click the sign up button, then MetaMask gets triggered in your browser. You verify, kind of you enter your credentials and so on. So in the end, you connect the wallet to this application that you have built. And from that point on, there's not kind of the website or kind of like the browser runtime interacting with this decentralized application anymore. It's this wallet interacting with it. So for example, if you want to trigger a transaction or make a trade or want to buy an NFT or something like that, in the end, the item that you want to buy triggers the transaction. You sign it with your wallet, then some Ether or some virtual currency is transferred, and then the transaction is done. And the record keeping for this transaction is done on the Ethereum blockchain.
Okay. Yeah. And then you are like a legitimate owner of one transaction, essentially, or of like one hash somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So like I described earlier, it's again using this this concept of asymmetric cryptography. So you have your wallet, and your wallet is your wallet because you have the private key of that wallet. And in the end, when you want to do a transaction, you sign it with your private wallet and with your private key. And then the transaction is done and operated between you and the smart contract and the kind of like counterparty that is behind it, if it's like a transaction between users. But I had kind of the fundamental paradigm shift that I wanted to say here or to express here is that it's not this communication between web application and the user's browsers. It's about having a wallet, having something like in which is in the possession of the user, and you're triggering transactions from that private wallet. And it's interacting with a smart contract, which is deployed on the blockchain.
Okay, meaning that if you create, for example, a sign-up process in your interplanetary file system-hosted magic website, then the user has to pay a little to, for example, sign up, and then triggers a transaction which says, yeah, you own this username, for example, how is it working with, if you have any data connected to your transactions? Let's say you want to upload a photo in combination with signing up for your service. Is that then also stored into the file system again, or is that up to you as a user of the blockchain, or how is it working?
So it really depends how you write the application, because not necessarily everything needs to be a transaction on the blockchain. So there's also kind of a data store behind each decentralized application. So you can also use that one. So if you do a sign up, that's kind of a very simple process, because I'm coming from the fintech world, and sign up in the fintech world always is super difficult, because kind of this process of creating a user and then kind of creating a link to the financial systems, like to your bank account, getting money in, and then being really able to buy something. So for example, like if you want to make a trade on Trade Republic, this takes you ages for the sign-up process, also because KYC needs to be done and so on and so forth. And in the blockchain world, with the integrated wallet in your browser, it's just one click. And it's like Facebook Connect or Google login, and you click the button, and you enter your credentials, and you're immediately logged in, but with this great advantage that it's not only the account which is linked to the application, it's also kind of a bank account. So with some currency which is connected to the application, and so therefore there's, and this is probably also the reason why decentralized finance was growing for the past 6 to 12 months a lot, because the sign-up process is very easy, and the barrier to start interacting with new platforms for financial products became so low that people very simply just try out stuff, and because you can, and that's not that easy in the fintech world.
Okay, because your wallet essentially is hashed, so you are the owner of that wallet, and you can just send transactions to each application without any verification, right? Which opens the doors for money laundering. And if I understand correctly, then let's say I build now a DApp, like a distributed app in Ether, which is called Crypto Countries, for example, where I sell those countries, like those virtual countries, NFT countries, and I generate like millions with it. Then my only problem is, I mean, I'm totally anonymous, right? I don't have to pay anything apart from my virtually hosted domain, which no one can stop. I'm totally anonymous. I can generate millions. I just have to get it out of the system somehow, right? This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, the New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist.
The topic of money laundry is around with cryptocurrencies for quite a while. Actually, I personally don't see it that critical, because in the meanwhile, and I'm not talking about the past 2 years, I'm talking about the past 5 years. So cryptocurrencies are not like a small topic, which is under the radar of regulators and lawmakers. Therefore, there's rules in place for quite a long time that, in the end, always comes into play once you have transactions between fiat money, so kind of like classical money, and crypto money. And so, for example, if you pay in euro to get some ether, or if you sell ether for euro and want to wire it somewhere, so then usually the controls are set up and come into play. And therefore, this economy that I just described with non-custodial wallets, so where people have Ether, they sign up and buy, I don't know, an NFT or like a country from you, it relies on the idea that people would not be able to get Ether because if you want to buy Ether or some cryptocurrency to sell to buy something on your platform, then they would have been KYC'd. And many decentralized applications, many decentralized finance applications use, for example, services like Ramp or MoonPay, which is bridges between the fiat world and the cryptocurrency world, where you do, for example, like a card transaction. But if you do it, you also have to KYC.
But I still could, let's say, take an empty suitcase, travel to Israel, go to some ATM there, some Bitcoin ATM there, and have a fake mustache and just fill my suitcase, right?
Well, so it's, there's also always then limits how much you would get like at these ATMs and so on. So, yeah, I think the money laundering is a topic like everywhere in the world. So not only in crypto, it's also in the traditional world. So there's even, and I'm always referring to this white paper that the Bundesfinanzministerium, so the Department of Finance of the Republic of Germany, wrote I think 2 years ago, and where they state that the danger of money laundering in the crypto space is lower than in the traditional financial ecosystem, because in the end, taking money in a suitcase from one country to the other is possible in the traditional world as well, and is used a lot to do money laundering. And in the Bitcoin and in the crypto world, each transaction is written like in the public internet, which means that's something I said a few years earlier as well. You're able to hunt kind of criminals with tools of tomorrow, because everything which is written in the blockchain stays there forever. So which means if you develop better tooling, and many money laundering monitors work in a way that they kind of try to gather as much information of Bitcoin and Ether addresses as possible, and try to kind of locate them somehow. So kind of that could be maintained by somebody from that region, or also specific persons. And then this the blockchain step by step gets a little bit more more known, and therefore you are then also able to find the people who did criminal action.
Okay. Yeah.
If
I would work in a central financial institution, I would actually invest into that space, right? And invest in such tools.
But I would also add like another thing, because in the end, we're like in the very beginning of decentralized applications and the decentralized economy. But what I'm really looking forward to is that the wallet becomes much more powerful, because in the end, you like a wallet is not only built to do financial transactions. In the end, you can have various tokens and various things or digital items in your wallet, and one of those items could be also a digital identity. Yeah, and in my perfect world scenario, you would like each wallet would have like a digital identity which is verified, and in the end, once you do a transaction, it does not only prove that you're the owner of the funds that are used in the transactions. So it would also make the proof that it's you, or that it's like a verified identity that is behind that transaction. And also in my perfect world, this kind of like the name of that identity behind the transaction should stay anonymous, because I'm also a big fan of private transactions and so on. But with the knowledge that it's a known person, you could be able to open that transaction once there is something illegal that happened there. Yeah, so you could build systems that are kind of like in default mode always pseudonymous, so you can do whatever you want. You can, I don't know, sell countries that don't exist, whatever. So you can feel free to do your cards business as well. But once something illegal is happening there, the people wouldn't be invisible anymore, and so that would be, from my point of view, the perfect combination between privacy and also kind of like freedom and independence and also everything that the libertarian people really want. But at the same time, it would give like an handle for legal enforcement if it's required.
So a passport would be one of the real world applications that you could actually build with it, right?
Yeah, and that people are doing it. So there's like in blockchain or like in Ethereum. So there's this this concept of a token, and that's actually a really interesting development where I'm also thinking like, hey, that kind of innovation wouldn't have happened in a traditional system that quickly as it did in the blockchain space, because for example, probably the most well-known token is the ERC20. In the end, what is a token? So a token is what is ERC20? ERC20 is like a standard for smart contracts, and it contains like a handful of methods that each contract that fulfills the ERC20 standard needs to write. So it's like an interface, if you want so. And this ERC20 enables people to kind of emit an own currency that is based on the Ethereum blockchain that can be used for a special purpose. Yeah. So there's, for example, there's like a separation between, for example, utility tokens and payment tokens and security tokens and so on. And each of these terms refers kind of to what is bound to kind of this token. So for example, there's utility tokens that can be used in platforms like S3 or like storage services and so on, where you use them as a currency. So where you kind of like pay for a unit of something, and then this token gets burned behind because it shouldn't be used anymore. So you can use it in systems like Payback, for example. So where people collect loyalty points somewhere, and then they can use it somewhere to buy a coffee machine, and then these get burned and so on. All these kind of things you can build with tokens, and tokens. And token development and token standards have been like a continuous stream of development in the Ethereum ecosystem. So there's also the ERC 721, which is the most hyped token right now. It's the NFT, the non-fungible token, which implies the idea that you can create tokens that are unique. Yeah, so like in probably we both in our childhood had these Panini albums where you collect stickers of Lothar Matthäus and famous soccer players of the past, and you exchange it with your friends in school. And these NFTs are meant to build collectibles like that. So you buy something, you're the kind of legitimate owner of that one piece of that digital asset, and you can transfer the ownership to somebody else and trade with it. And it's like, so especially in this space, for the past 3 or 4 months, there's like an insane hype going on, because people are monetizing their digital art with it, and not only kind of paintings or creative artworks that are kind of that come with that NFT that gives you the proof of ownership in that piece of art. People are also thinking about using it in music, so that you're the owner of some piece of music, or that kind of an artist is able to still participate in payments also in the future. For example, an artist can create a digital a digital artwork, sell it, and then the smart contract gives him or her like a fee of some percent of each transaction that's also done in the future, and that's kind of also like a way of monetization for artists that hasn't been there, kind of that's have never been there, because once like a piece of art is sold, then kind of it's out of your ecosystem. But yeah, and then maybe also to name as also another token project, it's there's also like an Ethereum identity standard, and this in the end is the idea also of having like a token representing a digital identity that is verified, and yeah, so in the end, it's super interesting to see all these developments going on, and in the end. So if somebody has an idea, it works in a way, the standard gets proposed, then it gets public, and then people start using them. And therefore, the development in new standards is super quick, and probably maybe also to make this referral to the traditional world of building applications again. So in the traditional world, you would kind of propose an API standard, and you would make it public, and then you wait for adoption. And in the blockchain world, this goes like very quick, and probably way quicker than it ever has been in the traditional world.
But you just mentioned the word adoption. I think one of the challenges will be, or still is, that whenever you want to use something like this, whenever you want to buy a certain ERC 721 token, you need to have that browser extension, right? You need to have the Web3 extension, and you need to use it, right?
Yeah, but you're not bound to MetaMask as with a browser extension. So it's in the end, MetaMask is one example of a wallet, and but that's it. But there's like many kind of wallets, and probably if you're like hardcore technical, you can also do all your transactions in the command line. Yeah, so that's in the end, the smart contract and the blockchain doesn't care about the tooling that you're using, and therefore there's also a lot of mobile first wallets, so there's like browser based like web based wallets and so on, and there was like developed also a new standard, it's called Wallet Connect, and this just makes sure that each of these wallets in the end connect to your application that you're using. And this creates this feeling of so you just click connect your wallet in your application, and then you can choose what wallet you're using, and then you start interacting, and it jumps like between devices and like between web and native apps and so on. So it's in the end open to you what you use.
So I could also, if I have like a traditional company and I want to invent my own virtual currency, I could also do that. Give that to my users by providing them some wallet through my classical database that then connects to those tokens.
Yes, but if you're a company that provides something to clients, you always need to have a very deep look into also regulatory aspects of it, because somehow also sounded to me that you could become like a custodian of your users, and probably you don't want that, because that's regulated business in Germany these days already. But yeah, so
maybe like a bit more practical example. So I also own an event company called OMR, and we issue tickets and we sell tickets. And we potentially also can issue tickets for free if we want. We can, let's say, build something like a point system, like Payback or something. And we don't want our users to have the Web3 extension or the MetaMask extension in their browser. Would this be possible without any regulatory aspects? Or
Yeah, for sure. So in the end, you would create a token, you would sell it to the users, and in the end, the users need to have some sort of tooling at their hand. But in the end, so there's also the concept of paper wallets, identify as the owner just by having kind of like your private key printed on a piece of paper. So in the end, you could make use of that idea as well, kind of to print tickets, and then people go to the event or they just show the QR code at the event, and then they are able to enter. But maybe to add something to kind of like the way how this use case would work on the blockchain, because what I find so fascinating is especially when it comes to tickets. For example, my most I don't know the topic where I have the hardest feelings is flight tickets. Yeah, in the end, it happened to me quite a few times that I had like a flight ticket these days before Corona. So I don't know how an airport looks from the inside anymore. But in these nostalgic days where we took airplanes. So you have this ticket and you're not able to sell it or to resell it. And even if there's demand, and especially on these destinations between, I don't know, Berlin and Munich, there would always be somebody who would take your ticket, but it's not a liquid market and I can't resell it. But even if you would be able to resell something, I don't know, kind of like for the soccer final, like for world championships or whatever, there's these insane prices and where kind of the black or gray markets go crazy and sell stuff for just insane prices and probably even tickets that are not real or are just a fraud. And you could implement a ticket system which is actually fair, so which means you could imply in the ticket that it's resellable, but you could also state in the smart contract that there's like a maximum price, yeah, so that kind of like prevent tickets from getting insanely expensive, and also in the end then also to have like a really active and also healthy second market for tickets. And you could even implement in that smart contract that you as the event organizer are still getting a share of these second market transactions. And I think that's super interesting. And in the end, it's like open technology, it's open standards. And that's what I like about it.
Yeah, you can even build, I think just shortly touching it, you can even build full organizations in the blockchain, right? In Ethereum, you could, like, if you just get started with Ether and Solidity, you realize, okay, yeah, I can pay a designer and he can get a share of the company, and I can arrange how people interact with each other and how to vote for the designer to come on board and stuff like that. It's really crazy. I think techies love it, right? Because it's so abstract. It's so, yeah, so like a real contract, and just living in the endless spheres of that blockchain. It's crazy. So I can just recommend everyone who never got into Ether and Solidity to touch this and get a feeling for how it actually works. And just spend a weekend or two or three to understand how this whole thing works. It's crazy.
Yeah. So there's, I think we're now talking for an hour, but there's probably still, I don't know, we're just scratched the top of the iceberg, we're still above the water line with all the topics. So kind of the one that you just refer to, the so-called decentralized autonomous organizations, which in the end is like an abstract concept of having like a full digitalization of corporate governance of an organization. So what does it mean? What is corporate governance to me? So in the end, if you create like an entity, if you found a company, there's certain things that you have to do. So there's like need to do your balance sheet once a year. You need to have a shareholder meeting once a year and so on and so forth. And kind of these governance operations in the end get automized. Yeah, so it's written in a smart contract on the blockchain, and each shareholder or stakeholder who's that actually? Somebody having a share in that organization. So there's like a token. Let's say there's 100 tokens and 100 shareholders. Each of the shareholders has a token, and with the possession of that of the token, which can be verified through the private key of the wallet holder, you can just sign, for example, votes with your token, because in the end, yeah, you're a shareholder, stakeholder in that organization, so you have a say, and that's super interesting because you can build companies theoretically with it. And so I would really hope that DAOs would become kind of like a digital GmbH, like a digital legal entity form in the future. So because it would have many advantages also for traditional companies, but you can build communities. There's projects doing this for open source projects, for example, because an open source project could have like tokens that are given to community members who contribute to the project, and probably you can link that the token also to revenues that the Open Source Foundation is having with the whole project. So in the end, it would be possible to give open source developers with those communities like a saying in the project, but also like a financial incentive. So when there is monetization coming out of their work, and it's super amazing. And there's probably 50 more examples like that. So it's great also to have an eye on those developments.
Okay. So what would be the three things you would mention as topics worth looking at or technologies worth looking at?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm still a big believer in Ethereum because Ethereum, in the end, kicked off the whole topic of smart contracts and really brought it to the broad public. So therefore, it has the biggest development ecosystem. There are the most developers also in the Ethereum community, and also you can learn a lot from the development. So kind of starting with a proof of work blockchain, now moving to a more energy efficient proof of stake blockchain, and all these transitions, how scaling is solved in the blockchain, and all the discussions around that. So I think Ethereum is really a living example to learn a lot about blockchains, about decentralized applications, and how the Web3 looks like. Also, a project that I find very interesting is Polkadot, Polkadot is a blockchain project which comes also from one of the inventors of the Ethereum blockchain. It's Gavin Wood, and it's developed here in Berlin by Parity Technologies. And so they, in the end, are building kind of like a blockchain system that also connects with other blockchains, which includes a lot of scalability concepts that Ethereum now is introducing, kind of like in the next versions of Ethereum. And so they learned from it, kind of from the past, and built a blockchain kind of with all the knowledge of their predecessors. So which is quite also interesting to follow. And in the end, I also see a lot of developers moving into that development ecosystem. Yeah, and then I would definitely also name all the things that we missed, actually. There's different consensus mechanisms. I think it makes a lot of sense to learn about the developments in that space, so especially proof of stake as kind of the next level of consensus mechanisms. There's different concepts that are inspired from the blockchain, but that are not blockchains anymore. So, for example, the so-called DEX, so which in the end it's directed graphs that are used also to store transactions and to validate transactions in a blockchain-like ecosystem. So in the end, also super interesting to follow what foundational technology is developed over there. And then all these concepts around blockchain technology, also oracles, so kind of getting verified real-world data into blockchain applications, for example, like flight information or some prices of a stock or something like that, and decentralized exchanges, so that people are able to trade between each other just with like a smart contract in the middle of them. So that's like an insane development in that space as well, kind of having more trading volume than Coinbase has these days. Yeah, and once you started to dig into all these topics, you will find 15 more, and then you will find 55 more, and then probably you will end up like me, discovering something new every day that really catches your interest. And I think then, yeah, you will build your next application on the Web3 as well.
So I actually did that. I have a little surprise for you left. I actually built a little dApp for you, especially, and it's called Time Machine, and we can now spin it up, and we send it a bit of ether and a bit of gas to actually crunch our transaction, and we now travel back in times to the early days at Solaris Bank, and we can actually observe yourself for a second. You were coding Ruby back then, quite early, and we now have the chance to actually whisper something into young Peter's ears. What would it be?
Well, you asked me that question already once before, and I don't remember what I said there. Damn it! but still, I would say. Well, Peter, you're on the right path. So I think it's because you mentioned a few things in your introduction, like there was the word Ruby, there was the word Solaris Bank, and in the end, if I wrap up the past 10, 15 years, it was always about like looking into something new and staying curious and staying hungry for new developments. And first you start with Ruby, then you work in financial industry, and now something completely new, like a paradigm shift in development happens, and you're part of it. And therefore I just can give the advice that I would give little Peter, I would also give to everybody. Just always look for these new opportunities and these new developments in technology, and kind of adopt them, help them to grow, develop your own projects and make them public. I think that's all bringing us forward.
Great advice. Stay young and foolish, right?
Yeah, so, exactly.
Thanks a lot, Peter. Was fun talking to you. And yeah, really an interesting topic, which I think we can potentially also tackle in a later episode again. It's so interesting and so hard to actually climb the first step there. So you helped a lot. Hope to also talk to you a third time potentially in the future. So yeah, looking forward what you're coming up with next. See you soon.
All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Fastly and the About You Cloud. If you want to know more about Fastly services, simply visit fastly.com/alphalist. If you want to get in touch with About You and hear more about the About You Cloud, simply write to hello@aboutyou.com. Thanks a lot.